New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. We're going to explore the applications of remote viewing today, and I'm delighted to be here in my little studio in Albuquerque with Jana Roge, who has come all the way from Germany. Jana is a special person to me because she is the managing editor of the New Thinking Aloud magazine. As of this moment in time, we're about to be releasing edition number 5. Number 6 is already in planning. Besides that, she is also the editor of Aperture, the magazine of the International Remote Viewing Association. In addition, she is the executive editor of an exciting, important, historical new book called Foundations of Controlled Remote Viewing. She is the owner of Centerlane Books, a publishing company focusing on scientific research in parapsychology. Additionally, Jana is a remote viewer herself and a remote viewing project manager and a researcher whose very extensive and interesting research we reported on in our previous video. In fact, if you haven't yet seen that video, I'm going to link to it now in the upper right corner of your screen. For those of you who are able to see the link, you can click directly on it. I think you'll find that interview very helpful in understanding what we'll be discussing today. And her research is about to be published. Welcome, Jana.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me here.
I'm delighted to be with you. And this topic of the practical applications of remote viewing is dear to my heart. I have been following practical applications of parapsychology for just about half a century now. And it's exciting for me to see that new vistas are being opened up by your work and other professionals in the field of remote viewing.
I'm excited, too, to somehow gotten into this place, mm-hmm. and being able to contribute a little bit to the development.
It's pretty well known now that there are some private consulting companies. I think maybe the most prominent is Gail Husik, who do consulting services based on remote viewing for corporate clients. And there are others who are less prominent. And I suspect that because clients like to keep things confidential, there's probably a lot more going on than I have any inkling about.
Yeah, we cannot really tell how much is going on. Mm-hmm. We have some remote viewers that I know of who are telling they are doing a work for clients in different fields. And we know, so, but most of us, we are not allowed to talk about about what we do. We're allowed to think, but not allowed to talk.
Well, the reason is generally because of the controversies surrounding parapsychology, remote viewing, the paranormal, that if you're in business, you don't want to involve your business in controversy. But if you think that you're going to get a competitive edge in one way or another from employing such methodologies, you want to use them and use them confidentially.
So I know from some of the bigger remote viewing consultants that they actually work with business clients, and even some are working with government clients, but we all have NDAs and can't really mention who we are working with. So our clients don't want anybody else to know that they do it. A lot of remote viewers work in work for private clients on a smaller scale, maybe And this is less confidential. And from time to time, we can talk about these projects or mention it. But it's just single projects. And some person contacts you with an inquiry to find a missing object or look into a past event and clarify some things or archaeological stuff. But these are mostly just singular projects. So one client with one question. And when this question is solved, then the project is over.
But I gather that it would be fair to say that there are also some large projects.
Yeah. Fortunately, yes. Mm-hmm. And we hope that at some point we will develop into a state where it's more accepted to use this kind of information gathering.
Well, as I pointed out in our previous interview, I expect that day will come, and I have already given it a label, Remote Viewing 4.0.
Yeah. Yeah.
The taboo is not going to last forever.
Yeah, it looks more like it's consistently fading.
Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say. And in fact, some people would say that this period that we've been in for the last 400-500 years of Western mechanistic materialism is a little blip in history. For most of human history, a world view accepting of the paranormal was the dominant view in every location.
Yeah, and other cultures don't have this big problem that we probably have with it. Yeah, so we are kind of pioneers still, and it's exciting to be a pioneer, but also from time to time, we're just thinking it would be nice if it was just normal.
And of course, there's now a lot of information available about some of the applied projects from the past. Over a million pages, I believe, of the government records of the 20 years of remote viewing have now been declassified and are available. And in fact, the highlights have been published in 4 volumes. And the work that Stefan Schwartz did years ago in what I would call psychic archaeology, or the application of remote viewing in archaeology, is now largely public. And remote view, we talk about it on this channel all of the time. Remote viewers who pinpointed the location of Saddam Hussein, for example. And so there are other instances in the public record. There's no hiding that. But let's talk about, at least in general terms, what it's like for you and your colleagues in addressing some of the challenges that, at least in principle, that clients are interested in these days.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, private people are interested in solving their private questions, finding things, or investigating past events.
Yeah.
Business clients are more interested in looking into the future, of course. And this is one feature of the psychic work, that you are able to cross boundaries between present and past and future.
Right. Which, according to many people, is already an impossibility.
Yeah, true. But still, we always had a future prediction and forecasting and mediumship, or people are always interested in knowing what's next. It's not as easy as it sounds to just look into the future, get information if you want to use the information. For example, if you try to find out about technology, you cannot just look into the future and then copy it into the now, because then it wouldn't be the future in the way it developed.
Furthermore, imagine a person 100 years ago, if they could see us today doing what we're doing right at this very moment with video cameras, they wouldn't know how to describe it even.
Right. Yeah, you cannot describe what you don't know. It's not completely true. You can partially describe
it. Yeah.
This is one of the strengths of method-based remote viewing, that you learn to just describe, don't name things. But for example, if you're trying to describe something technological and you have no technology background, take our phones, right? Something 50 years ago would describe what it is. He or she would say it's a flat box in this size and there's some flickering image in it. Wouldn't tell us anything about the function.
Right.
It's some kind of electricity. So if we try to find out more, we have to have a clue, drawing roadmaps, finding out how to address the topic. And it is a multi-layered approach. Let's take this example, technology. Without mentioning what kind of technology, we can talk about it. We can address certain technologies that we already have and track it into the future and see how long this technology is used. And in tracking it into the future, we have to address a specific point now and specific points where we can at least assume they are really present in the future. It's easier, for example, if you think about buildings. A building is standing here right now. I can address it. I can address the same building in 5 years. I can address the same building in 10 years. And then somehow maybe it disappears. And so you get a report that this building is no longer there or no longer in the same function. Remote viewers can also describe concepts, so the function of a building. This is another very interesting part. The remote, as opposed to OBEs, for example,
out-of-body experience.
Out-of-body experiences. You, as in psychic means, you can go somewhere and look at this house and tell me it's a red brick house, two-story high, such and such size and layout and so on. But just looking from the outside, a remote viewer could also tell you this building is a school, a museum, a hospital. This is conceptual knowledge that you get. So even if you cannot really describe what's going on, you can have this conceptual knowledge. And you can try, if you track something in the future, does this concept change? Then you have to track different kinds of technologies that we have now and see what happens with them in the future. And you can track things that we are now that are, let's say, still in development. Things that we have a little clue about. It's not really happening. It's not really present, but we are doing research on it. We are thinking about it. So with thinking about a subject, it is we can have a grasp and can try to track this. And we can, in addition, try to jump directly into the future and tell from their perspective how they see things or how they manage things. And then put all this stuff together and compare it and come to a conclusion, which would probably not allow us to rebuild stuff that we see in the future, but we know which path is worth to follow. We can know it's worth to invest in this technology, and we can just skip investing in this technology. This is more likely to happen.
Yeah, so one potential client might be an investment company that invests in startups, where you have 100 applications for a startup, and you can afford to invest in 10 of them, let's say.
Yeah. Or maybe they have already invested and want to know if their investment was a good choice, or they should change something, or how it turns out with the already made decisions they already made.
Or to look at the personnel.
Yeah, this is one of the other applications that remote viewers are used to make decisions about staffing. For example, you have different candidates and try to find out which is the best one. But this is part of you don't necessarily have to use remote viewing for describing people's features or
Well, back in the day when I ran an organization, a small nonprofit called the Intuition Network, there were intuitive consultants, and often they would be asked, for example, do you think the leadership in this particular company is effective? How are the dynamics among the people in this company? And without interviewing them or knowing them, they would go within themselves and come up with reports about the quality of particular people who were guiding a corporate entity.
What I do in applications of PSI, I use, I work with, I wouldn't say I use, I work with different kinds of psychic.
Yeah.
I have remote viewers. I also have some natural psychics, some people who do constellation work or other kinds of work, and I put it together.
Yes.
And let's take this example that you brought up. A remote viewing has certain qualities. For example, that the viewer is blind to the target. He or she wouldn't know. So if it's helpful for your questions that the viewer down know in upfront what the target is, that you can trust the data that comes up in a way, you can use remote viewing. And then in addition, you can target people, describe people with psychics who do more generic work, and they look at the photo and link to the photo and tell you about this person. It's also valuable and can be a helpful addition to combine, or a helpful way of working to combine both approaches.
Well, the question obviously that comes up, is it better to take the average of several talented people? They could be remote viewers or natural psychics or dowsers or any, there are many different styles of engaging in psychic work. Or is it better to work with one really talented person?
The answer for me is it is better to have several of them. As far as I have seen, no psychic has ever been 100% correct.
Yeah.
So even if you have a very, very talented remote viewer or psychic, and you know in 4 out of 5 cases he or she is correct, you will never know if this one is the fifth one.
As I recall, Lynn Buchanan, who was trying to keep statistics on this sort of thing, talked about Joe McMonagle, one of the most famous of the remote viewers, and he told me, yes, he can be 100% correct 10% of the time.
I heard different accounts about Joe's specific accuracy, going from 1 out of 5 to 1 out of 10, so we don't know, but still it's the same problem. And we have spectacular sessions and very good hits. It's a very good proof of the functionality of psychic abilities. And for operational work, this is why I won't trust a single person.
I have I've certainly seen remote viewings where every detail provided by a viewer was accurate. So you could say 100% accuracy describing a particular target in detail. That does occur.
Right. It happened to me. As a viewer, I have some sessions that I like to show that are very good. And I know about all the other sessions that I did that I just screwed up.
So from a statistical point of view, it makes sense to involve several people and to look at where their readings overlap.
Yeah. Still, we have problems. It's too easy to say, let's take 5 people, let them do the same task, and if 4 out of 5 report the same thing, it might be true. there is still the possibility that the fifth one is true and the other four are incorrect. So it's hard for analysts to do a good job on remote viewing. It is helpful, and this is why analysts like to work with method-based remote viewing. They have a certain structure. They have a very clear distinction between, let's say they try to have a clear distinction between data and noise, mm-hmm. and try to work with this process. And they are aware of the problem and can give you a better outcome to work with when you do an analysis. And natural psychics, if they ever record what they do, it is in an unstructured way. It's hard to work this out and find the underlying data that you can rely on and work with.
And this is what CRV is about.
Yeah, it's part of what CRV is about. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier for analysts to work with. And CRV and the descendants, so yeah. the later mm-hmm. Versions that came up. Still, it is helpful to have natural psychics. I wouldn't say that they're not or that are less reliable in what they do. It's just most of them first are not aware of this noise problem. It is very helpful that in remote viewing, at least in the structured methods, we are aware of this problem of guessing, mental noise, what we call analytical overlay. And because we are aware of it, we have ways to try to deal with it. And natural psychics don't spend a thought on it. It's just they come up with something. And I have also experienced some of them have a hard time to believe themselves. For example, you make a prediction. And then you see it is happening in exactly the way you predicted. Mm-hmm. You get into, you have to digest this experience.
I have had some very positive experiences with natural psychics, and I know quite a few of them, who take it upon themselves out of the blue because they get an inspiration. Mm-hmm. Unexpected, spontaneous, and they would call me up and say, Jeffrey, I have a message for you. Mm-hmm. And in one case, for example, I was involved in some business negotiations. And out of the blue, a person who I hadn't talked to recently, who was some distance away, called and said, I know you're involved in business negotiations, and I have to tell you, I was told to tell you, or I had an inner inspiration. I had to tell you, you can get much more than you think you can right now. You should drive a harder bargain. And in fact, that worked out beautifully.
Mm-hmm. But if people do these kind of things, they have previous experience. They know how it feels to get an inspiration or a message, mm-hmm. what really is data. And in order to know how it feels to get this input, you have to have experience with it. And so for the remote viewers, I think it is a little bit easier, mm-hmm. because they learn a process, they have a method, and whatever comes up, they can blame it on the process. And for a natural psychic, it's just the person and what is happening, and you have to maintain a balance, mm-hmm. not going into, not feeling overconfident in what's happening, not being too skeptical about it or not mm-hmm. telling things. Yeah. It happens very often that you perceive things, don't say it. And later you say, oh, I knew it. Yeah. It happens in everyday life.
Sure.
This is also a benefit that we get for our lives, mm-hmm. I think, through this constant experience, perceiving things. We call it internal editing, mm-hmm. not saying it or not writing it down. Mm-hmm. And then later it turns out to be true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everybody has had that experience, I'm sure, that we don't trust our intuitions.
Yeah, but it's a valuable lesson for our intuition in daily life.
Mm-hmm.
I experienced this, right? Yeah, in the past few years.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to trust more what my, you would call it intuition, gut feeling, or whatever. You don't have a proof. It feels, yeah, you cannot really tell where it comes from. But I try to believe more what I get. And
of course, there's always the risk of being wrong or yeah. feeling foolish. I've certainly had other people who thought they were very psychic, who called me up and said, you know, I have this guidance for you, and it couldn't have been worse.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I had the instinct not to pay any attention to it in the first place.
I think this is also an effect of this unstructured working.
Mm-hmm.
You have this, I don't know if there is also a first-time effect. Maybe it is. We can go into this, but let's say you have an experience or prediction where you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And then you have the next one and you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the next data and you have no concept about decline effect or mm-hmm. analytical overlay. Of course, you're assuming that you're true and you're in full confidence that yeah. what you're telling is right. And then you're absolutely disappointed.
Yes.
Or maybe in neglection when it doesn't happen.
I know of such an instance. We talked about it, I think, informally. There's a person right now working with ITC, getting information through, comes through an old-fashioned telephone, and apparently from spirit sources. And on two occasions, this person has made a lot of money by making small wagers, $10 or $5 at a time. He's made $50,000 now in the lottery. And the odds are, I think, of two hits in the lottery like that. Each one is one in 10,000. So to get the exact four-digit number that comes up in the lottery. So his odds are one in 100 million of having two hits like that in a row. And he's convinced that now he can do it anytime. He'll have all the money he ever needs because he expects it's always going to work this way.
Yeah, right. And this is where we will see what happens.
We will see what happens.
We can just tell from past observations
mm-hmm.
that people did it in a way
yeah.
and they had a number of hits in a row and then just suddenly luck changed.
Right.
And they had a number of misses in a row.
It happens that way. And one of the hallmarks of people who are engaged in financial speculation, traders,
mm-hmm.
is that the past does not predict the future.
Yeah.
If you have a trading system that worked in the past, it doesn't mean it's going to work tomorrow.
Right. And still, we were talking about models.
Yes.
People try to find models or explanation why this happens.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the very, let's say more scientific models talking about decline effect,
yeah.
neurological things going on. And we have the more spiritual models talking about karma or belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
And still we don't know.
But your work as a remote viewer, when we talk about applied projects in remote viewing, it seems to me that the future for this field is to do it at what I would call an industrial level,
yeah.
to be able to work with large-scale corporate clients and meet their needs. And that, I gather, that is your vision of doing things, and it requires a mindset that is very different from working on small projects, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, yeah. Small projects are very, it's nothing that you can really use to make a living mm-hmm. off from. It's just too much work on both ends, on the end of the viewers and the project management. The larger scale projects where you have a number of sessions, maybe projects that run for months or even years, is a completely different kind of work. I still don't know how I got into this place. And at some point, I would also say that I believe a little bit in guidance.
Mm-hmm.
I had some interesting experiences with guidance in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming from the scientific side.
Yeah.
I wanted to do my research. I wanted to do my projects, and I tried to design experiments to find out more about these questions. And when I looked at my plans, I said, oh, wow, I need a group of viewers and I need years of time to do it. We know it's complicated to get funding for scientific projects, even in the absolutely grounded scientific world, even more in parapsychology.
Sure. There's always a struggle for funding in almost every field.
Right. So I had this desire to do this work. I was looking for possible funding sources, just thinking about the experiments. Turned out that we have clients who pay for the operational work, and the operational work is co-financing my time in the research.
That sounds like almost an ideal situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I get both. of course, it's still time consuming to do the operational work.
But what it implies, and I think this is key, is that if you're doing a serious, large scale applied project, it's going to need to have a research component.
Yeah. Again, coming from the point where we designed experience or tried to find solutions for their questions. With this example that I mentioned before, where you look into different types of existing technologies compared with the future, certainly it plays a role for your client if you tell them you need 500 sessions or you need 600 sessions.
Yeah.
It depends on how you ask the questions. And again, we have, when we are looking into the future, it is not only the problem that we cannot really tell how reliable a future prediction is. Some people say looking into the future is less correct or less accurate than looking into the present or past. We have no measurement about that.
Well, I know I've done many interviews with my friend Russell Targ, and he tells me over and over again that future targets are no harder for remote viewers than real-time targets.
Yeah, but we need a long time measurement.
Yeah.
So again, I was sitting there creating experiments.
Mm-hmm.
How we can measure this?
Yeah.
And also we have some, the interesting part is we have some indications from singular experiences and sessions, where it seems like if you apply the idea of an open future where you have different possible outcomes, not a completely determined future, but different possibilities, and you look into one of them, that it is more likely to happen this way. And we cannot have proof because we have a session. We have an outcome. This is probably a little bit unlikely that this outcome would happen, but we have no second experience that tells us what would have happened without the session. So it's just an idea, and we try to right now, one of our projects is concerned to find out if there is a mechanism that applies this influence on future outcomes. And going from this point, if we try to tell about the future for a client, we have to be cautious in what we do and how we do it.
Mm-hmm.
So this means we have to find out before what we are doing, before we decide for one way in approaching the question.
I know at one time, I was asked by a medical researcher to use remote viewing to come up with a cure for multiple sclerosis, which is a disease that has defied a cure up until now, to my knowledge. It seems to be, you know, a very debilitating condition that it can be managed, but it can't be cured.
Mm. I've heard about this project, and I think they had 5 different options. Am I right?
Well, what happened in the particular one I'm describing is that the medical researcher believed he had funding to do this, and so we were working on developing a proposal. But it became clear that the funder had backed out.
Oh,
so never got off the ground, and that happens a lot. I think where, in my experience, you'll find the potential funders who are kind of interested, but closing the deal is not always as easy as developing an initial interest.
Right, and the bigger the organization is, the longer it takes to make a deal.
Yeah,
with the government, it takes months, even years.
Mm-hmm.
Private corporations or companies.
But when you have a challenge like that, like let's say, let's find a cure for multiple sclerosis, then you have to ask yourself, well, how do we even begin to go about it?
Yeah.
Like, what are the questions we need to ask? How would we begin to come up with an answer for that? And as you've pointed out, you can't just go into the future and say, oh, here we were in the year 3020 and they've solved the problem and this is the answer. That's not going to work.
Yeah. Even if we have some indications of what's happening in the future. Let's say they tell us the cars are driving on streets, self-charging in an electrical way.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many different factors. For example, what kind of batteries do they use?
Mm-hmm.
And the battery technology from today is certainly not the battery technology in the future.
But what you just suggested a moment ago is come up with 5 possible alternatives and see which of those is the most promising.
Right. And maybe it is a 6th one that we don't know yet.
Yeah.
So we have always this other option.
Mm-hmm.
We have certain options and one that is called other things that we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So since remote viewing is a descriptive process, again, describe, don't name, you cannot really describe things that you don't know. The idea to train people to do remote viewing who have this knowledge in their certain field. Train experts, business experts, to use remote viewing as viewers, in addition to other trained viewers, to give us this little missing piece to know what they're talking about.
I have heard, for example, remote viewers who want to work in the medical area find it very helpful to study anatomy.
Yeah.
So they have some language.
Right. Yeah, or the opposite approach would be get some medical doctors and train them in remote viewing and have them in your team. Yeah. They would know how to describe.
And I'm under the impression that more and more of that is happening. People with specialized knowledge realize that if they learned remote viewing, it would be helpful. Even if they don't use it themselves, they would be able to work with other remote viewers and have a better appreciation for the whole process.
Or they could work with remote viewers from the operator's perspective. And know how to read the sessions.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a remote viewing session on paper, there is a lot more in the session that you can only really understand when you know what the viewer is doing, especially for the method-based approaches like CRV, If you have the CRV session on paper and you know CRV, you can read, I don't know how many percent, but I think for an untrained person, just looking at what the written words.
I have looked at CRV transcripts and they don't make much sense to me.
Yeah, and they would make sense if you knew the process. Yeah. So we also can train these people to read the transcripts, mm-hmm. to know about the process.
Which is part of the project management side of things.
Also, we have to train clients in how to task remote viewers. Mm-hmm. They have very, they have to be educated in how to create your question, mm-hmm. How to formulate your question in a way that you even get an answer from the remote viewers, that it's not ambiguous or specific. We can always speak from or come from a point of talking about intuition. Mm-hmm. Intuition is something that everybody knows. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows the feeling that there is a certain intuition. And working through intuition, you come up with applied psi. Like, for example, remote viewing. So we are not starting off with remote viewing, but it comes later in the process.
Since I was once president of a small organization called the Intuition Network, the psychic work, remote viewing work, is a subcategory of intuition. Intuition is larger because it includes your whole life experience. The psychic side of things is in many ways, it's the kernel of intuition.
I think there was a study that business leaders, and they were asked for how they make decisions, mm-hmm. and they answered that, the most successful business leaders base their decisions on intuition. So coming from this perspective, and I think this really again shows this development in the field, if you go to a company and you tell them, you know there is intuition, and you know you can make good decisions if you have a good intuition. Mm-hmm. Now I tell you we can train intuition. Mm-hmm. You can develop and strengthen your intuition. Yeah. And this is still or already a point now. Mm-hmm. In our society, where they would say, yes, I'm going with it. Let's train intuition.
Sure.
They say yes. And then if you then come up with psychic remote viewing, this is a point where they now say, don't know. Let's not openly talk about it. Yeah. But it's just the next step.
It's to me, it's a form of intuition.
Yeah, it's.
And someday it will be regarded as natural and acceptable and completely understandable in terms of our metaphysics and our larger worldview, that we are living in a cultural era right now that is off balance. And that's why the things that we're discussing are in many circles considered a taboo topic, not to be discussed.
Mm. When I started with remote viewing, I had a regular business. Or maybe I go back 10 years when I started with my first psychic experiences, mm-hmm. which were not remote viewing. Mm-hmm. But still getting information and doing things. I had for a while, I had two different lives. One was my regular business life, mm-hmm. and one was my other side. Mm-hmm. And I was really hesitant to show people what I think about things. Mm-hmm. And I thought if I show my business clients, and I had several government clients at this time or bigger companies, mm-hmm. if I would show them what I'm thinking or doing, they would just run away and say, oh, she's crazy. Mm-hmm. And it needed years and years for me to slowly try to get those things together and to accept that this is just me. Mm-hmm. And I lost some of my clients, but not the majority. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, I found the majority of people, if you start to tell them about these things and there are certain keywords mm-hmm. that you mention in the conversation, and then it's like a dam is breaking and they tell, oh yeah, I can tell you. I've also made this experience or this and this and yeah. Mm-hmm. I've never told anybody because I always thought everybody would call me crazy. And this is what everybody thinks. It's, all of us, we have this experience and nobody's talking about mm-hmm. it.
It's particularly true in the scientific world that scientists have as many paranormal experiences as other people, but they're so afraid to talk about it.
Yeah, and since nobody talks about it, everybody assumes that he or she is the only one having mm-hmm. these things. Mm-hmm. And if we would only say it out loud, we would see, okay, it's with everybody.
And you know what? What we're doing right at this moment, programs like this, we are contributing to the societal conversation and making a little dent in that situation where year after year, people are becoming more and more open.
Yeah, yeah. And I learned through these conversations, so just let's say, taken from my samples. Mm-hmm. I learned almost everybody has these experiences, and this brought me into a point where I can just easily tell people what I'm doing and what I'm thinking, because I know there is resonance. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's one or two that they won't believe it, or they decided not to believe it or not go. It's okay. So, but with the majority, they are open.
Well, what I'd like to dig into with you is the idea of engaging in a large-scale, long-term remote viewing project for a corporate client. I'm pretty sure that the research that you're doing, that we talked about in our previous interview, paves the way for that, because if a client comes to you, let's just say hypothetically, it's a medical problem. They would like to come up with a cure for a disease that is yet to be discovered. You have a sense of the steps that you need to go through to begin to address that problem.
Yeah, and not only me. Mm-hmm. I hope that the work that I do also paves the way for other remote viewers to do it. The more we have, the better it is for the whole field.
I mean, to begin with, you have a team of people that you can count on, and you have a not just a track record for each member of the team, but you know their particular strengths and weaknesses in terms of their perceptual styles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I have a larger team for this scientific work, mm-hmm. And there are different teams for different projects. Mm-hmm. The largest project that we do right now, it's a one-year project where we just try to create a baseline for a certain measurement, and then we apply some change and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And this group is about 40 people. Mm-hmm. And then I have smaller groups for other projects, and also we have some viewers who are in several groups and even in the operational groups.
So if a client comes to you with a project like that, you have the tools to begin to shape a proposal together. And obviously, the client is going to want to know, how much is this going to cost? Can they afford it? Is it in their budget? Can they work with you, or is it impossible?
Oh, yeah. I vividly remember the first time I did it and wrote this kind of proposal. And looking at the number on the end of my calculation, I said, oh my God, what are they going to say? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we know in other business applications in consulting, they always charge this amounts. Mm-hmm. So I thought for maybe 2-3 days and went on and off, and how do I really want to show them my proposal? Is it correct? Mm-hmm. And then I went over it, and no, we have to do it in this way. Mm-hmm. And it was a proposal that, yeah, also would be a multi-year project. And I showed it to the client.
Yeah.
And I heard back from them, okay, looks reasonable. We don't have the money right now, but we're going to get it. Mm-hmm. We are organizing funding. Mm-hmm. And this is when the first time that I did it in this scale, and I felt really, this is great acknowledgement for the process and that they value the work that is in it. Or maybe that the outcome that you can get from working with psychics or remote viewers is worth the investment because you cannot get the same answers anywhere else.
And we're talking now about a kind of project that might involve, as you say, years. And I'm going to guess we might be talking about hundreds of individual trials.
Yeah, in this case, it was hundreds of sessions that they planned. Yeah, but otherwise, I wouldn't have felt good. Of course, you can take one star remote viewer and ask them the question and tell me what you think about it. And, I wouldn't be sure. And maybe I'm too much of a scientist in this case. But what we tell them is true and not just.
But you're basing such a proposal on a database that you've worked hard to gather, that you know what the statistical likelihood is of a particular group of people, at least based on past experience.
Right. And this is also a good thing that I can show to a client my data, my database, and all the statistics and show them it's not just fairy tales or rumors, what I'm telling them.
And you are doing it at what I would call an industrial level.
Yeah, right now it is.
I mean, I did a nice interview many years ago with Joe McMonagall, who was asked by a group of people in Japan to get involved in an archaeological project to locate the burial of one of the very ancient rulers of Japan, thousands of years ago.
He looked for the grave of a woman.
That's right. It was an empress, an ancient empress who was, if I remember correctly, also something of a shamaness herself. And he described to me how he worked alone on that project for months, over and over and over again.
Joe is a natural psychic, and he was always working in this natural approach.
Okay.
With ERV. So the kind ERV, extended remote viewing, is a format of using this generic approach with some elements that Skip brought in from the Monroe Institute. And he formed this version that they they called it ERV.
Well, you know much more about the details of the different labels, the different letters that go before the RV than I do. I've never been able to kind of keep it straight in my mind. But Joe worked by himself, and for months he would keep adding and adding and adding to this picture until he was able to give them an accurate description. And to my knowledge, they actually located the burial site, and a documentary was made about it in Japan.
Right, right. And he's famous in Japan for doing it. But Joe has decades of experience and is a very skilled natural psychic. So,
to my knowledge, he's considered one of the very best.
So you cannot easily break down what Joe did to other remote viewers. Or maybe in 10 years.
Or to engage in some of these large-scale, long-term projects.
I have some people in my group who are really, what's a good English term, fabulous in what they do. I just recently worked with Bill and Sandy Ray, and Sandy, Bill's wife. And Bill was one of the former commanders of the unit and also trained remote viewer. He's trained in CRV, also in ERV. And he worked as a monitor. Sandy, his wife, worked as the viewer for this project. She did three or four sessions, and she was so incredibly good on this target. And right off the bat, she described what the target is, what the question is. There is a little bit of AOL, and they really sorted it out as AOL.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the session is clean data and really amazing. So it's not only Joe, but there are certain people who can do it, but also Sandy has decades of experience.
I tend to think, personally, that there is a karmic element to all of this that will never be quantized, that it's some people, it's maybe even a question of destiny, like my friend Carol Dreyer, now deceased, who was a natural psychic, and I probably wouldn't be here talking to you today if she hadn't spontaneously invited me down to Los Angeles, where she had a little cable TV interview show, and interviewed me. And then she said, "Jeffrey, now you go back up to the Bay Area, where I was then living in San Francisco, and you do what I'm doing, set up a little interview program on cable TV, and I predict it will be successful beyond your wildest expectations."
And it is.
It did, because within 2-3 years, we were out on the satellite being carried by 120 stations all across North America. I could never have imagined such a thing when she first said that to me.
How many followers do we have now? 150,000, roughly?
Viewers?
Yeah.
Subscribers? We're up to about 160,000 subscribers. Yeah.
10,000.
And we're somewhere near 20 million views.
Yeah.
On this channel. But when we were out on public television, the audience was even larger.
Mm.
Somewhere, I calculated it, somewhere over 100 million views.
Wow. Yeah.
The market has changed enormously since then, but I've been doing interviews now for half a century.
Would you say we had a peak in the 80s and then...
The internet changed everything, and,
and
now, you know, you've in the paranormal field alone, there must be hundreds of podcasts on it. When I began doing this work in 1972 on the radio on KPFA in Berkeley, before I got into video or television, it was very rare that, you know, there were radio programs late night. Typically radio programs that talked about it. This was long before Coast to Coast and the programs that exist today on radio. So, yes, I would say that the field, it's still something of an underground phenomenon. You know, we're not doing interviews like this on network television yet.
Mm.
But there are even network programs that address the paranormal. They're typically more sensationalistic, and their goal, I tried to break into Hollywood at one time, and I realized they're not interested in educational television, which is in effect what we're doing.
Yeah.
They're interested in entertainment, and they're willing to stretch the truth and provide an angle because it's all about a numbers game for them. You got to have enough viewers to get enough advertisers. And I throughout my entire career, I've simply rejected that model. I'm about educating people.
Yeah, right. So the entertainment part is one. Yeah, one part that is...
It's an important part of our culture, and sometimes the entertainment programs really break new ground, important ground, or they cover topics that I wouldn't cover. For example, all of the ghost hunters, they're all over television now. It's very important, and I think for a long time, the parapsychology research community ignored them completely as being, you know, beneath us. And so they don't have scientific standards. But I think now we're coming to a different viewpoint in parapsychology, that we can work together with these groups, that they can become, in effect, citizen scientists.
We have an institute in Germany, IGPP.
Yes.
And they take this stuff serious and they do research also in the ghost hunter stuff and all the other phenomena, which is very interesting.
Not long ago on this channel, I interviewed an anthropologist who did her doctoral dissertation on ghost hunting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I do think public awareness is very slowly growing and growing and growing. And I don't see any reason to expect that that's going to stop or reverse itself.
Hmm. And part of it is that we speak openly about what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And, or that I experience when I tell my friends what I'm doing. So my friends or my family or the next level is okay with, again, telling other people what Jana is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't hold it back or try to cover it or, Of course, the first question that you always get is, okay, you're doing this stuff. Can you live on it? Can you make a living with it?
Mm-hmm.
And how?
And that's the big issue right now for people who invest a lot of time and money to get trained in remote viewing is, will it benefit them financially over their lives?
Mm, yes. And again, the answer is not, it is not only one answer. Depends on what you want to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're just seeking the experience that you are more than what you thought you are, or that the world is different, or that we have this consciousness field, it's sufficient to just do a little exploration, get a little experience, do a weekend course. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Mm-hmm. So you do not have to pay for weeks and weeks of training and invest thousands of
dollars. As you have done.
Then people who are doing ARV, associative remote viewing, where you try to predict outcomes with binary choices.
Mm-hmm.
So you assign one target or object for option one and another target for option two.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the remote viewer viewing this, and whatever they get tells you what the outcome would be.
For a wager, is the stock going to go up or down?
Right, but in this working field, you try to apply very, very different targets to make it as easy as possible to make this distinction whether the remote viewer described this one or this one. So basically, you have to be able to tell an apple from a pencil, and this doesn't require much of skills in this area. It's basic, very basic.
Yeah.
And again, you don't need week-long expensive training. It's only when you come into the operational field where it's about this, what I mentioned, this conceptual knowledge and about really getting very detailed data going in depth. Mm-hmm. This is where you need specialized training.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have remote viewers who had this, basic experience, and they do not understand why they cannot be useful for the operational work. And you have to explain there is a difference. Yeah.
Well, in my case, that would be the I would be the poster boy for that. I had a great remote viewing session in 1976, but I don't consider myself a professional remote viewer. It was a wonderful experience. And I showed other people many times, you can do it. The first time is often the easiest, but to do it consistently over and over again, like Joe McMonagall did on this Japanese project, or you do in your projects with groups of people, that takes it to a different level. That's not the same as simply knowing that it's possible.
Right. But this is where we need specialized
use.
And it is with every other skill set, you can have a guitar and you can play a song at the mm-hmm. campfire, mm-hmm. and this is okay. But in order to be a concert guitarist, you have to have more training and more background.
It becomes a lifelong activity. You're always learning, and you do it because you have an enormous passion for it.
And everywhere, if it's in music, in sports, in wherever you apply certain skills, you have specialized training, and you also have trainers mm-hmm. who can lead you or guide you on this path.
Yeah.
So a trainer is not only the one who would show you how it works. They would show you or observe you and then tell you what you can do better or where you can make changes to become better.
Well, Jana Roga, it's very exciting to share your enthusiasm for this work and the depth of your knowledge and experience and research and the plans and at least a general outline of the projects in which you are engaged. It will be very interesting for me to watch your work as it unfolds over the coming years. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Thank you, Jim.
And thank you so much for coming to Albuquerque and being here with me today.
Yeah. I don't know what to say at this point. I'm just happy to be here, and I'm excited of how things come together.
I am too, and I'm very grateful once again for all the work you have done in creating and bringing into reality the New Thinking Aloud magazine. It's been a blessing.
Let's make this last point about guidance. Mm. Guidance can only work if you're already moving. Mm-hmm. You have to go. Just make step by step, and then guidance will give you direction, but you cannot just sit down and waiting for things to happen. Mm. And this is, we are here now.
It's a good point. We are here. And once again, from the bottom of my heart, thank you.
Yeah.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death? New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.